This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, today presenting highlights of Pacifica's live coverage of the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina.
This is Pacifica Radio live at in Charlotte, North Carolina, at the DNC. And also in studio with me is Davey D and Mark Bibawi out of KPFT. Davey D from KPFA. Now, Davey, we were out in the hot sun. Was it Sunday?
It was Sunday.
March.
Yes, historic.
One of the biggest.
It was the historic Wall Street South March. It was one of many demonstrations that's been going on here, but this was the largest in the crown jewel, in which you saw everybody from the Occupy to immigrants to prison industrial complex advocates. People want to abolish that. Everybody and anybody was out there for this.
I'm carrying a Free Bradley Manning banner, and it says whistleblowing is not a crime. Bradley Manning has been in prison for over 2 years for allegedly releasing documents and videos detailing U.S. war crimes and other war crimes and corruption in governments, not only in the U.S. and around the world, which in turn inspired Occupy in a lot of ways. So you could say that Bradley Manning is one of the most important, if he did what they say he did, is one of the most important heroes in American history.
As we are continuing to walk down Tryon Street, you hear them say, this chant is Bush Obama, same old drama. They're carrying a Bradley Manning sign. It is raining, so people are obviously committed to this. They're not letting the bad weather keep them out of this. Do you feel that both parties are the same?
Well, in many ways, yes, and as far as what we're marching about today, political prisoners like Bradley Manning, yes, Bush with his Guantanamo, Obama said that he would close it. He didn't follow through. He said he would end the Afghanistan and Iraq war when he was campaigning. He didn't follow through. He escalated the Afghan war. He eventually pulled out of Iraq, but there's still thousands of troops there, and he continues to use mercenaries like Blackwater, which are virtually exempt from international and American law. He's just continuing American foreign policy as much as Bush is. That's why we're saying Bush, Obama, same old drama.
I'm Robert Knight of WBAI's 5 o'clock shadow, reporting for the Pacifica Radio Network's live coverage of the Democratic National Convention. Political protesters, occupiers, and other DNC dissidents in Charlotte, North Carolina, could be forgiven if some of the out-of-town security personnel they see there today were to provoke a flashback to the Chicago Democratic Convention of 1968, where tear gas flowed and chaos prevailed during a gleeful police riot presided over by Mayor Richard J. Daley.
The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
Today, dozens of Chicago's off-duty checkerboard-hatted police are patrolling the DNC, fresh from their recent suppression of anti-NATO protests in the Windy City. But they're by no means the only security carpetbaggers in Charlotte today. 1,000 or more Transportation Security Administration agents are patrolling transit hubs and conducting pat-downs and bag searches at the convention sites. And at least another 1,000 out-of-town cops have been summoned to Charlotte, in addition to hundreds of agents of the FBI, FEMA, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the state of North Carolina, all to support their local police during the Democratic Convention, as they did in Tampa with the Republicans. Moreover, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg County Police Department recently obtained a $50 million federal grant for the convention, much of which was spent buying and installing as many as 500 high-resolution cameras. The security booty also includes those innocuously named license plate readers, whose optics are actually so acute that they may also be used as a massive input source for the nascent technology of facial recognition, likely to be processed one day at the Utah computer farm now being constructed by the National Security Agency. But even before then, the faces and plates of unwitting conventioneers are being cataloged and cross-referenced in real time by Trapwire, a new interstate network that calls data from local surveillance systems and notifies other jurisdictions about people and actions considered suspicious. Thus, we have now reached a day that there are literally more security cameras outside the convention center than there are TV cameras inside. And with the assistance of nearly as many out-of-town police and security agents as there are protesters, Charlotte has placed a new wrinkle on the old Southern tradition of importing people from afar to conduct local work. However, this time the product is not cotton, but surveillance under Tampa and Charlotte's thoroughly modern practice that can only be called sharecropping. For the Pacifica Radio Network's live coverage of the 2012 Democratic National Convention, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
This is Pacifica Radio's live coverage of this event. I'm Davey D, along with Margaret Prescott and Mark Babawi. Did I pronounce it?
Babawi,
there you go.
Close enough.
There you have it. You know, one of the things, Mark, that we've been talking about, we've been finding a lot of invigorating discussion is, can you be progressive and a Democrat?
That is a tough question.
That's the tough question. And we wanted to really explore that this evening because there are some that make the case that you can't be a true progressive and inside this Democratic Party, which in their opinion is becoming increasingly corporatized and in many instances have betrayed progressive principles. Mm-hmm. Of course, you were at the Progressive Caucus Convention, the People's Convention.
I was.
Yeah, and people have a very, very different take there. They feel that you can push and you can bring progressive values to the forefront. And so wanted to explore that a little bit this evening. And to help us do that, we have a couple of people that I think wrestle with this question frequently. On the phone line with us, we have Norman Solomon. He is the founder of Progressive Democrats of America. He's an author, a journalist, and somebody who is running for Congress early this year. Joining him is Glenn Ford. He is the co-founder of the Black Agenda Report, a longtime radio veteran, and more importantly, a freedom fighter who is constantly raising this issue. Gentlemen, welcome to our show. How are you this evening? Live from Charlotte, North Carolina, here at the Democratic Nat. Oh, boy, I'm sorry. I'm hitting buttons left and right. Glenn, are you there? Okay, let me just
try. How about Norman? Is Norman there?
Norman, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, Norman is there.
Okay, we got Norman. This is live radio, folks. We're pressing buttons, and let's get Glenn Ford there. Glenn, are you there?
No, I'm right here, Davey.
Okay, now we got you.
Two for two.
There you go. Gentlemen, we were talking about, can you be progressive and can you be a Democrat in 2012, considering all that's at stake? And I know, as I mentioned earlier, this is something that is a constant conversation, and I want to start with you, Norman. How do you feel about that, being the founder of Progressive Democrats of America?
Well, yeah, I should tweak and correct the intro. I'm not the founder, but I am co-chair with John Conyers and Donna Smith from California Nurses Association of the Healthcare Not Warfare campaign that is launched by Progressive Democrats of America. I'm not too concerned about the labels. I'm concerned about the politics, what we fight for, what we stand for. And the reality is that you have a few people who are in Congress in the Democratic Party who I certainly consider progressive. I consider Barbara Lee. I consider Dennis Kucinich, who campaigned for me in California. These are progressive folks. And I think we need to ask ourselves what the implications are of our conduct. The implications of the conduct, unfortunately, of the vast majority of the delegates who we're seeing on the floor at the convention this week is conformity and loyalist to an Obama administration that has moved steadily rightward and moved the party rightward in the last 4 years. And also the implications of, on the other hand, the attitude that we hear expressed sometimes in these terms that voting is useless, which is, I think, a perspective that is not true and also dangerous when we see the right wing. So I would see two, and I would put it in these terms, there are two things that we could say progressives have a responsibility to do at all times. One is to fight the right wing, the racists, the xenophobes, the bigots, and fight them tooth and nail. And the other responsibility is to move progressive policy into implementation and to organize. And some of that involves voting, and a heck of a lot of it doesn't. It means mobilizing.
Okay, let me put that same question to you, Glenn. Glenn Ford.
Yeah, well, you know, I voted for Jesse Jackson in 84 and 88 at that particular time in history, and he was running as a Democrat. That was, I'm sure, the correct thing to do. And we supported Cynthia McKinney, who had been a Democrat. Nobody condemned her for the sin of having been. However, the Democrats, I like to say that Wall Street is to the Democrats in many ways what big energy is to the Republicans. And so if we look at that party in those broad kinds of terms and see their deep links, intimate links to Wall Street, which is the enemy of the world, you know, that's obviously a very unhealthy environment to find people worthy of voting for in.
Well, I think
Glenn has a great point.
I think we look at we can find individuals who will rise above. You know, I'm getting an echo here. Okay, we can always find individuals who will have democratic values at the end of the day. But can you change the system that the Democratic Party exists in right now? Can you change the direction that it's moving in, or do you become swallowed up no matter how progressive you may feel that you are?
Well, you know, let's talk about the obviously good people, the folk who everybody involved in this conversation would say, people who have some very redeeming qualities, like Barbara Lee, certainly like Kucinich, and there are others. When their association with the Democratic Party causes them to lie, and I mean effectively lie, because of their affiliation with that party, because they cannot embarrass that party, because of the rules that they have to recognize and the behavior that they have to act out because they're in that party. To that extent, they're being corrupted by that party and by that association. And so I think that if we can in terms of dealing with all kinds of different political actors, come to all kinds of agreements based upon different issues, who we can coalesce with and who we cannot. But there's one thing that is central, and that is we do not tolerate the people being lied to. And this party makes folk, even like Barbara Lee, lie on occasion in order to protect her president and other valuable properties of the Democratic Party.
Well, I think we could say, too, that one of the ways that lies are told is by silence. And when we have a convention which is already off to a start here this week of worshiping war, of saying that war is something that we should celebrate, that's an example of how the National Democratic Party, deferring to the guy in the Oval Office, has moved rightward, has moved more militaristic in the last 4 years. And a question that we continually have to try to answer, not just theoretically, but most importantly in what we do, is what is a plausible strategy for us to mobilize a strong progressive movement that can move the discourse in the direction of truth-telling as we see it, and also galvanizing power from the grassroots. I think we do need to find ways to respond to the question of how we're going to effectively fight the right. And a sad reality is that the conformist loyalists, as I think of them, of the Obama administration, with the rationale of, well, you have a right wing to fight, so you've got to circle the wagons and support the president, that has actually empowered the right wing by leaving the only avenue for progressive populism and rage about the economy to be a right-wing pathway. And so we have an opportunity, but also a challenge, to say that there is a clear and present danger of reenacting, I think to some degree with all the differences of the parallels, 1980 and 2000, when many progressives said, and I was one of them, we were so sick and tired of President Carter moving in a military direction, gutting the social safety net, and on, what difference much did it make whether we'd had a President Reagan or a President Carter? I think historically we can say now that was a mistake. In 2000, there were many progressives, and I was one of them, who said, we are so sick of the Clinton attacks on working people, on women on welfare, and a long list, that who cared very much whether it was going to be a President Gore or President George W. Bush. That also was a historic mistake. So I think that we have this challenge to, on the one hand, acknowledge that reality, and on the other hand, not give any power, our power, over to the Democratic Party, because we've got to mobilize, including in the streets.
Norman, you mentioned earlier, Glenn, I'm going to come back to you with this now. In just a second. Norman mentioned something, and I want Glenn to answer it first and then go back to Norman. This move to the right that you described by the Democratic Party, do you think this is an attempt to court the so-called center, or is it being pushed internally, or what motivates this move to the right, do you think? First Glenn and then Norman.
Well, you certainly are going to have the right more effectively moving its own agenda if there is no resistance from what purports to be the left. And one of the reasons that we have been calling Barack Obama the more effective evil is because he has successfully neutralized, first of all, the most left constituency in the country, and that's Black America. I think that blacks probably make up half of the part of the polity that can reasonably be called progressive, and that part has been totally neutralized by Barack Obama. We do have a record here to look at. It's not like the difference between 79 and 81. We know that Barack Obama passed a preventive detention law. I don't believe that George Bush could have passed that preventive detention law, because there would have been very, very serious opposition, not just on the Hill, but in the streets, to Bush and a preventive detention legislation. But Barack Obama could pass it. He was more effective in getting that evil done. And we could go on and on about how right-wing agendas have been accomplished with the aid of Obama, or because there has been no resistance from those who normally would. So I'm not more afraid of Romney than I am of Obama. Obama has given us a great deal of reason to fear him.
Yeah, you know, the same ways in which we are encouraged to be compliant with the Democratic Party leadership have everything to do with the self-demobilization of progressives. And I think a lot of it revolves around refusal to speak truthfully on a daily basis publicly what sometimes we're willing and often able and eager to say privately, and that is, we live in a warfare state, we have an administration in the thrall and in the service of Wall Street, and by not telling that truth and acting on it, we give more and more power to those, including inside the hierarchy of the Democratic Party, to move it continually rightward. And I would say that there's a sort of an ironic agreement, for different reasons, between the Rahm Emanuels and the very most corporatist wing of the Democratic Party leadership, and some on the left who say that, gee, you can't be active in the electoral process, including in the Democratic Party, and speak truthfully as a progressive. I think we've got to be willing, whether we're in the streets or in the jails or in the electoral process, to speak truthfully at all times about our situation. I'd like to address the initial question with one word. Remember, the question is, you know, why is this happening? Why the move, the dragging of the Democratic Party nationally to the right, farther and farther from the base? You know, people on the floor of the convention are to the left of the leadership of the party as we speak. I would use one word. If there was one word I was going to employ to answer that question, it's the word austerity. This is a heightened class war being waged from the top down, and austerity is seen as an imperative by those on Wall Street who want whoever is in the White House, and it happens to be Obama right now,
to continue to wring out of working people and wannabe working people all that they can get in terms of maximized profits, and unfortunately the result being a lot of suffering. So I think whether we're talking about in California what's going on with Governor Brown or nationally what's going on with the Congress and the White House, this is an austerity war that is going to go on well past November, to put it mildly.
We're getting ready to wrap up, so maybe in about 30 seconds or less, I'll start off with you, Norm. Do we go a third party where you can really have unrestrained progressives? Or do you try to change it from within? And same question to you, Glenn. We'll start off with you, Norm. You got about 30 seconds to hit that.
Yeah, I think a third party is a bridge to nowhere. I wish the Tea Party and the right wing had done a third party. That way they wouldn't be running the Republican Party right now. I think we have to deal with reality that we're going to have either a President Romney or a President Obama. Okay. I do not want a President Romney.
Okay, and Glenn, 30 seconds or less.
I've already said I'm not. I'm no more afraid of Romney than I am afraid of Barack Obama. In terms of third party, that's a hard thing to build. I know what is indispensable, and that is we need a grassroots movement. And one cannot just say, well, that's hard, too. If we don't get that, then we are doomed.
There you have it. Glenn Ford from the Black Agenda Report and Norman Solomon, author and member of the Progressive Democrats of America. I want to thank you all for being on our live coverage here at the DNC Pacifica Radio. We will be right back.
I keep flashing back on Y2K when the billionaires took your voting rights away. Convicted felons got personal lists. A lot of innocent people's names were dismissed. If you're satisfied with who's in charge.
Felonious acts of the billionaires here reporting from Charlotte. We're the smallest, most beleaguered minority in America today. And here at the Democratic Convention, it feels like we're even smaller and more beleaguered. All of us were out in force in Tampa last week, but there aren't enough billionaires in Charlotte to fill a clown limousine. It's too bad more of us aren't here, because Charlotte is a wonderful place to be, mainly because it's smack dab in the middle of a right-to-work state. Workers in North Carolina can't be forced to join unions, which means lower wages and wimpier benefits for them and bigger profits for us. You can be sure that once we've got the Senate, House, and White House in billionaire-friendly hands come January, we're going to make America a right-to-work country. Our nation's teachers, nurses, firefighters, and cops will gnash their teeth in anguish as all those pensions they've been paying into for so many years are legislated out of existence. And the few private employee unions that still exist today will go the way of the dodo. Some of our critics point out, correctly, that our elected officials, governors like John Kasich of Ohio and Scott Walker of Wisconsin, go after the unions because they are the only entities powerful enough to get Democrats elected in the face of the torrent of cash unleashed by our Chamber of Commerce and Americans for Prosperity. As the only countervailing force against our complete corporate takeover of the U.S., unions are bound to earn our special ire. But it's more than that. We've heard so much whining about the offshoring and outsourcing we've done over the last 30 years, how what used to be lots of good-paying American jobs with decent benefits are now low-paying indentured servitude in China. Maybe it's time for we billionaires to change that policy. America can become the manufacturing powerhouse it used to be back in the beginning of the last century, as soon as we can enact policies that create the same work environment that existed back in 1900, it will become affordable for us to do business here once again. And unionized workers just aren't the compliant drones content to work long hours with no overtime pay and no benefits for starvation wages that we prefer to employ. As soon as the unions have been obliterated, we billionaires are bringing jobs back to America. We'll offer our new American workers the same pay their Chinese counterparts get and the same protections. We'll erect nets around all of our new right-to-work factories so our employees can't fall to their deaths when they jump off the roof in despair. I'm so delighted the Democrats are holding their convention here. Welcome to Charlotte. Enjoy all the amenities that a right-to-work state can offer, union members. Enjoy a taste of your future in a new union-free America. This has been Felonious Acts for the Billionaires.
Don't vote. If you really want to fight in the war.
Don't vote.
If you like the way we're treating the poor.
Don't vote.
If you don't care about education.
Don't vote.
Hey, the billionaires don't want you to vote.
We're back here, Pacifica Radio's live coverage at the DNC, Charlotte, North Carolina. Davey D, along with Margaret Prescott and Mark Babawi. And joining us as we get into the issue of immigration and how this administration shapes up to it. We have two people that are very much on the front line. One is no stranger to our airwaves, Faviana Rodriguez. When you look at posters all around the world, including the posters that are here circulating around that says Fear No Papers and all that, that is her artwork. She is coming straight off the bus from Tucson, Arizona, which is the belly of the beast when you look at the immigration battle. She joins us. And then somebody who was unafraid in terms of walking 1,500 miles across the country to Washington, D.C., to the door of Barack Obama, is one of the dreamers. We're talking about Gabby Pacheco. You all are here tonight. And people would say, well, why here at the Democratic Convention when Barack Obama is making gestures to give folks a break on deportations and all that other stuff? It doesn't seem like you all are buying it. And I'll start off with you, Faviana.
Yes, I came to the DNC to really support the immigrant rights movement. Barack Obama has the record for deporting the most immigrants. And although he passed a move to give work permits to young people that is still far from legalization, it still doesn't do anything to address ESCOM, which is the mandatory program that he made mandatory in 2011 that is partly why we have over a million deportations, something that has broken all records. We still have families being separated from their parents. We have children in foster care losing their parental rights because of this broken immigration system. So we're here to really send a message that immigration is not about the Democrats or the Republicans. This is a human rights issue, and he has to address it as a human rights crisis.
How do you see this, considering you went to the White House? You talk to the folks. How are you seeing things, especially now? And this is Gabby.
Well, I think we're especially proud of our community. I think that for a very long time, we've been working really hard to, you know, have these politicians listen to us and really show the human face of the crisis, of the colossal waste that we're having by allowing for young people to be in detention centers instead of colleges and universities and schools and out doing things in the community. We have people that are artists, people that are just, you know, incredible members of our society. And so for us, you know, we celebrate the fact that Barack Obama made that political move to make something historic, right? But I think that for us, we take that as re-energizing our movement and knowing that, you know, that it's a small piece of the pie, a very small piece, and we got to continue to fight. And for us, you know, we, like Fabi said, this is not about Republicans, this is not about Democrats, this is about, you know, these leaders that get elected by the people to do something. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is that, you know, they're in action. We see a lot of words, we see a lot of speeches, a lot of claps, but no action.
Yeah, I wanted to raise, I mean, we hear quite a bit, especially in our audience, the Pacifica audience, about it's not about Democrats, it's not about Republicans, or there isn't a difference between the two parties. I was interested in looking at the statistic that after the RNC, Mitt Romney didn't get much of a bounce in the polls. Basically, Barack Obama was 1 percentage point ahead before and 1 percentage point ahead afterwards. The only change that has happened is that Mitt Romney has gone up 4 points in among Latino voters. And it's the first week that that has happened. And it's interesting to me that it's happening right about now when the RNC happened and they put forward their platform. And here we are at the DNC. And looking at the data, we see that there is a jump in the polls. So do you think that, I mean, does that concern you? Do you think that we do have to be concerned about it, hearing everything you're saying, that both bar, I mean, he has, you know, he's done all of the things that you've said he's done, but does this bounce concern you among Latino voters? 30% and 0% among Black voters.
Yes, of course it concerns us because at the end of the day, Latinos are a population. We're very powerful. I think we are not one big blob. We're a very diverse population. The reality is that almost one out of three Latinos know someone who's been deported. So immigration has affected all of us. People know about the horror stories. They know about the suffering. So it concerns us in the sense where we have to mobilize to get the vote out. At the same time, I think we need to have a rethinking of strategy here because the issue has been, you know, Latinos as an artist, even artists mobilized for the president back in 2008. So did Latinos. Yet we haven't necessarily been able to hold him accountable. And I think that voting is one step, and then getting people ready to hold him accountable is another thing. So it concerns me, but I think that it should not be a reason for us to get any less harsh on our demands of the president. I think that the terror that has been inflicted on our communities cannot be dismissed, or we cannot look it over just because it's election time.
Gabby?
To me, that tells these politicians that our community is not a community that is going to be bought out by beautiful speeches and great ads on TV and everything that is being told. It means that our community is listening and that they're making decisions. And that at the end of the day, it is going to be the politicians, and we're going to have to do a really, you know, important role in making sure that our community goes out to vote and that they vote smart. But at the end of the day, we're hoping that it's going to be the record of these politicians that people are going to be voting on, and not so much the speeches. And so to me, you know, that's a good message to the Obama campaign, that they need to do more if they want to get our votes.
Both you and Faviana said you have to kind of retool, so to speak. And one of the impacts that we've seen since 2008 were the harsh anti-immigration laws in states, on the state side. First question to you is, how do you actually deal with that in places like Arizona and in Alabama? You know, what is it like, especially when you're undocumented, as your situation is, Gabby? And how do you counter that now when you look at it, when you redevelop strategy? Do you start to take these local elections to a new dimension?
Definitely. And I think that, you know, the message and what we've been able to see in Arizona is the power of the people. Being able to take out Russell Pierce and, you know, take him out of that seat, he did so much damage to Arizona.
And Russell Pierce is one of the architects behind SB 1070.
That's correct. And, you know, he's all tied up with the ALEC group and GEO group and all this money behind the prison industrial complex. And so to us, you know, that shows, again, our power that we have, but it also shows that we need to be paying attention. We sometimes get too lost into the national politics. You know, for too many years, we were all fighting for immigration reform, and we forgot to look at our backyard and forgot to see all these anti-immigrant legislations that started brewing. And that, you know, that was because of 287G Secure Communities. But it also was because we were just blindsided. We were hoping for this, you know, immigration reform to come in and save us all. But in reality, what started happening in the states is that we started getting more harsher and harsher anti-immigrant legislation.
We have to go to the floor. President Michelle Obama is entering the hall.
Serving as your First Lady is an honor and a privilege. But back when we first came together 4 years ago, I still had some concerns about this journey we'd begun. While I believed deeply in my husband's vision for this country, and I was certain he would make an extraordinary president, and the truth is, I loved the life we had built for our girls. And I deeply loved the man I had built that life with. And I didn't want that to change if he became president. I loved Barack just the way he was. You see, even back then, when Barack was a senator and a presidential candidate, to me, he was still the guy who picked me up for our dates in a car that was so rusted out. I could actually see the pavement going by in a hole in the passenger side door. He was the guy whose proudest possession was a coffee table he'd found in a dumpster, and whose only pair of decent shoes was a half size too small. But see, when Barack started telling me about his family, see, now that's when I knew I had found a kindred spirit, someone whose values and upbringing were so much like mine. You see, Barack and I were both raised by families who didn't have much in the way of money or material possessions, but who had given us something far more valuable: their unconditional love, their unflinching sacrifice, and the chance to go places they had never imagined for themselves. My father was a pump operator at the city water plant. And he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when my brother and I were young. And even as a kid, I knew there were plenty of days when he was in pain. And I knew there were plenty of mornings when it was a struggle for him to simply get out of bed. But every morning, I watched my father wake up with a smile, grab his walker, prop himself up against the bathroom sink, and slowly shave and button his uniform. And when he returned home after a long day's work, my brother and I would stand at the top of the stairs of our little apartment, patiently waiting to greet him, watching as he reached down to lift one leg and then the other to slowly climb his way into our arms. But despite these challenges, my dad hardly ever missed a day of work. He and my mom were determined to give me and my brother the kind of education they could only dream of. And when my brother and I finally made it to college, nearly all of our tuition came from student loans and grants, but my dad still had to pay a tiny portion of that tuition himself. And every semester, he was determined to pay that bill right on time, even taking out loans when he fell short. He was so proud to be sending his kids to college, and he made sure we never missed a registration deadline because his check was late. You see, for my dad, that's what it meant to be a man. Like so many of us. That was the measure of his success in life, being able to earn a decent living that allowed him to support his family. And as I got to know Barack, I realized that even though he had grown up all the way across the country, he'd been brought up just like me. Barack was raised by a single mom who struggled to pay the bills and by grandparents who stepped in when she needed help. Barack's grandmother started out as a secretary at a community bank, and she moved quickly up the ranks, but like so many women, she hit a glass ceiling. And for years, men no more qualified than she was, men she had actually trained, were promoted up the ladder ahead of her, earning more and more money while Barack's family continued to scrape by. But day after day, she kept on waking up at dawn to catch the bus, arriving at work before anyone else, giving her best without complaint or regret. And she would often tell Barack, "So long as you kids do well, Bear, that's all that really matters." Like so many American families, our families weren't asking for much. They didn't begrudge anyone else's success or care that others had much more than they did. In fact, they admired it. They simply believed in that fundamental American promise that even if you don't start out with much, if you work hard and do what you're supposed to do, you should be able to build a decent life for yourself and an even better life for your kids and grandkids. That's how they raised us. That's what we learned from their example. We learned about dignity and decency, that how hard you work matters more than how much you make, that helping others means more than just getting ahead yourself. We learned about honesty and integrity, that the truth matters, that you don't take shortcuts or play by your own set of rules. And success doesn't count unless you earn it fair and square. We learned about gratitude and humility, that so many people had a hand in our success, from the teachers who inspired us to the janitors who kept our school clean. And we were taught to value everyone's contribution and treat everyone with respect. Those are the values that Barack and I and so many of you are trying to pass on to our own children. That's who we are. And standing before you 4 years ago, I knew that I didn't want any of that to change if Barack became president. Well, today, after so many struggles and triumphs and moments that have tested my husband in ways I never could have imagined, I have seen firsthand that being president doesn't change who you are. No, it reveals who you are. You see, I've gotten to see up close and personal what being president really looks like. And I've seen how the issues that come across a president's desk are always the hard ones. You know, the problems where no amount of data or numbers will get you to the right answer. The judgment calls where the stakes are so high and there is no margin for error. And as president, you're going to get all kinds of advice from all kinds of people. But at the end of the day, when it comes time to make that decision as president, all you have to guide you are your values and your vision and the life experiences that make you who you are. So when it comes to rebuilding our economy, Barack is thinking about folks like my dad and like his grandmother. He's thinking about the pride that comes from a hard day's work. That's why he signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, to help women get equal pay for equal work. That's why he cut taxes for working families and small businesses and fought to get the auto industry back on its feet. That's how he brought our economy from the brink of collapse to creating jobs again, jobs you can raise a family on, good jobs, right here in the United States of America. When it comes to the health of our families, Barack refused to listen to all those folks who told him to leave health reform for another day, another president. He didn't care whether it was the easy thing to do politically. No, that's not how he was raised. He cared that it was the right thing to do. He did it because he believes that here in America, our grandparents should be able to afford their medicine. Our kids should be able to see a doctor when they're sick. And no one in this country should ever go broke because of an accident or an illness. And he believes that women are more than capable of making our own choices about our bodies and our health care. That's what my husband stands for. When it comes to giving our kids the education they deserve, Barack knows that, like me and like so many of you, he never could have attended college without financial aid. And believe it or not, when we were first married, our combined monthly student loan bill was actually higher than our mortgage. Yeah, we were so young, so in love, and so in debt. And that's why Barack has fought so hard to increase student aid and keep interest rates down, because he wants every young person to fulfill their promise and be able to attend college without a mountain of debt. So in the end, for Barack, these issues aren't political. They're personal, because Barack knows what it means when a family struggles. He knows what it means to want something more for your kids and grandkids. Barack knows the American dream because he's lived it. And he wants everyone in this country, everyone, to have the same opportunity, no matter who we are or where we're from or what we look like or who we love. And he believes that when you've worked hard and done well and walked through that doorway of opportunity, you do not slam it shut behind you. No, you reach back and you give other folks the same chances that help you succeed. So when people ask me whether being in the White House has changed my husband, I can honestly say that when it comes to his character and his convictions and his heart, Barack Obama is still the same man I fell in love with all those years ago. Yeah. He's the same man who started his career by turning down high-paying jobs and instead working in struggling neighborhoods where a steel plant shut down, fighting to rebuild those communities and get folks back to work. Because for Barack, success isn't about how much money you make. It's about the difference you make in people's lives. He's the same man when our girls were first born, would anxiously check their cribs every few minutes to ensure that they were still breathing, proudly showing them off to everyone we knew. You see, that's the man who sits down with me and our girls for dinner nearly every night, patiently answering questions about issues in the news, strategizing about middle school friendships. That's the man I see in those quiet moments late at night, hunched over his desk, poring over the letters people have sent him. The letter from the father struggling to pay his bills, from the woman dying of cancer whose insurance company won't cover her care, from the young people with so much promise but so few opportunities. And I see the concern in his eyes. And I hear the determination in his voice as he tells me, "You won't believe what these folks are going through, Michelle. It's not right. We've got to keep working to fix this. We've got so much more to do." I see how those stories our collection of struggles and hopes and dreams, I see how that's what drives Barack Obama every single day. And I didn't think that it was possible, but let me tell you, today I love my husband even more than I did 4 years ago, even more than I did 23 years ago when we first met. Let me tell you why. See, I love that he has never forgotten how he started. I love that we can trust Barack to do what he says he's going to do, even when it's hard, especially when it's hard. Yeah, I love that for Barack, there is no such thing as us and them. He doesn't care whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, or none of the above. He knows that we all love our country, and he is always ready to listen to good ideas. He's always looking for the very best in everyone he meets. And I love that even in the toughest moments, when we're all sweating it, when we're worried that the bill won't pass and it seems like all is lost. See, Barack never lets himself get distracted by the chatter and the noise. No, just like his grandmother, he just keeps getting up and moving forward with patience and wisdom and courage and grace. And he reminds me that we are playing a long game here, and that change is hard, and change is slow, and it never happens all at once, but eventually we get there. We always do. We get there because of folks like my dad, folks like Barack's grandmother, men and women who said to themselves, "I may not have a chance to fulfill my dreams, but maybe my children will. Maybe my grandchildren will." See, so many of us stand here tonight because of their sacrifice and longing and steadfast love, because time and again they swallowed their fears and doubts and did what was hard. So today, when the challenges we face start to seem overwhelming or even impossible, let us never forget that doing the impossible is the history of this nation. It is who we are as Americans. It is how this country was built. And if our parents and grandparents could toil and struggle for us, you know, if they could raise beams of steel to the sky, send a man to the moon, connect the world with a touch of a button, then surely we can keep on sacrificing and building for our own kids and grandkids, right? And if so many brave men and women could wear our country's uniform and sacrifice their lives for our most fundamental rights, then surely we can do our part as citizens of this great democracy to exercise those rights. Surely we can get to the polls on Election Day and make our voices heard. If farmers and blacksmiths could win independence from an empire, if immigrants could leave behind everything they knew for a better life on our shores, if women could be dragged to jail for seeking the vote, if a generation could defeat a depression and define greatness for all time, if a young preacher could lift us to the mountaintop with his righteous dream, and if proud Americans can be who they are and boldly stand at the altar with who they love, then surely, surely, we can give everyone in this country a fair chance at that great American dream. Because in the end, more than anything else, that is the story of this country. The story of unwavering hope grounded in unyielding struggle. That is what has made my story and Barack's story and so many other American stories possible. And let me tell you something, I say all of this tonight, not just as First Lady, no. Not just as a wife. You see, at the end of the day, my most important title is still Mom in Chief. My daughters are still the heart of my heart and the center of my world. But let me tell you, today, I have none of those worries from 4 years ago, no. Not about whether Barack and I were doing what was best for our girls. Because today, I know from experience that if I truly want to leave a better world for my daughters and for all of our sons and daughters, if we want to give all of our children a foundation for their dreams and opportunities worthy of their promise, If we want to give them that sense of limitless possibility, that belief that here in America, there is always something better out there if you're willing to work for it, then we must work like never before. And we must once again come together and stand together for the man we can trust to keep moving this great country forward. My husband, our president, Barack Obama. Thank you. God bless you. God bless America.
And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, engineered by Reggie Johnson and Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your comments with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.